to be with us today. So thank you very much from the University of Sharjah. Scott, by day, teaches young Muslim women, exclusively women, no men at all. He was telling me over lunch that he is, as it were, their first introduction to a male teacher, to a non-Muslim teacher, and to a Western teacher, I think. So that must be quite a challenging daily teaching experience for him. So that's the day job. And then in the evenings, doubtless at weekends, on other occasions, he is editing and working on the letters and the journal of Henry Martin. He's probably the person who knows Henry Martin, I suspect, best in the world at this point. So we're very, very privileged indeed to have you with us speaking today. So we look forward to the next 45 minutes or so, and then there'll be half an hour of question and answers after that on the making of a missionary, Henry Martin, and the preparation for an East India Company chaplaincy. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for that. I want to thank St. John's College and the Henry Martin Center for making this series of lectures possible. I think it's nice in a time like this, economically, that we make time for remembrance of our heritage and events that have shaped us. And I think what we choose to remember is what forms us and identifies us as individuals, as institutions, and as a society. I remember approximately 27 years ago, arriving in Islamabad, Pakistan, to begin a year and a half of service as a volunteer English teacher with Afghan refugees. Unfortunately, I failed to heed the instructions I received about what I should and shouldn't eat, and I soon found myself prostrate with stomach problems. In my distress, our school principal kindly brought me a book to read while I was recovering. It was Constant Padwick's biography of Henry Martin. And it was my first introduction to the man. I was riveted by the story of Martin, and even more so by the passion he evidenced in his work. Today, his story is much less well known than it was, say, 100 years ago. Few parents name their children after him as they once did. And though he appears in stained glass windows in a number of churches and in a whole series of windows at Truro Cathedral, most churchgoers would struggle to tell his story. Martin, in the 7 years between his departure from Britain for India until his death at the age of 31, translated the New Testament in Hindustani, or modern Urdu, completed a large part of the work of the Old Testament as well. And amidst preaching duties in India, he engaged in early work on a new Arabic translation. He simultaneously commenced work on the Persian Bible, completing in the final year of his life the Persian New Testament and Psalms in Shiraz, Persia. While there, he also engaged in a seminal written debate with Islamic scholars on the theological tenets of Christianity and Islam that has had a far-reaching impact on future Islamic and Christian interaction. Martin died in Tokat, Turkey, in an abortive effort to reach Britain in hope of recovering his ailing health. His work, accomplished in the span of just a few years, was remarkable. Bishop Eyre Chatterton, in his History of the Church of England in India, suggests that Martin achieved more than any missionary since Francis Xavier. Nevertheless, it was arguably his personal journals that were the source of his greatest impact. The surviving portions, combined with portions of his personal correspondence, were generously used in the best-selling memoirs prepared by his Cambridge friend John Sargent, and later by Sargent's son-in-law and William Wilberforce's son, Bishop Samuel Wilberforce. These works inspired a generation of Christian workers, both in overseas mission and in the domestic church. Today, however, I want to talk about how Henry Martin got to India in the first place. The preparation that led a son of a Cornish mine employee first to Cambridge and then to the decision to engage in Christian work in India. I wish to speak of Henry Martin himself and then consider in detail the network that selected and vetted him. Finally, I'd like to describe the final steps that prepared Martin for the task ahead. Martin was born in Truro, Cornwall in 1781. Several errors surrounding his background crept into the early biographies and still appear time to time. The most notable was from Sargent's biography that said that Henry's father, John Martin, had begun life as a laborer in the mines of Gwynedd. In fact, John Martin had been the chief accountant and cashier for the Unity Wheel Mine, and when the mine was sold, he received a 1/24th share of the mine's profits. He didn't sit on the funds. In conjunction with Ralph Daniel of Truro, he became a silent partner in a carpet manufacturer that employed over 700 people. Possessed of new prosperity, he moved his family to the newly laid Princess Street, where he was remembered for his daily, regular peripatetic exercise under the coinage hall next to his house. I can imagine the worthies of Truro gathering every day for calisthenics. The 7-year-old Henry was enrolled in Truro Grammar School, where he had the great benefit of being taught by Dr. Cornelius Cardew, the chaplain to the Prince of Wales. The school, in fact, was known at the time as the Eton of Cornwall, though it takes some imagination. Today I hear it's a very good bistro. Other students of Cardew at Truro included Richard Cussey Vivian and Sir Humphrey Davy. Of particular importance to Martin's development was fellow student John Kempthorne, the son of Admiral James Kempthorne, and 6 years older than Henry. Kempthorne took the young Martin under his protection, and later Kempthorne went on to study here at St. John's, where he was both senior wrangler and first Smith Prize winner in mathematics for 1796. The 14-year-old Martin first attempted to enter Oxford, but was unsuccessful. Oxford's loss was Cambridge's gain. In October 1797, at the age of 16, Martin entered St. John's College, undoubtedly with Kempthorne's encouragement. He was a conscientious, though not devout, youth. In his first 2 years were marked by noteworthy progress in academics, but by no particular interest in spiritual matters. Kempthorne encouraged Martin to reflect on this attitude with only limited success. Martin reported in June 1799, "Kempthorne attempted to persuade me that I ought to attend to reading, not for the praise of men, but for the glory of God. This seemed strange to me, but reasonable." Martin later recalled his summer visit home in 1799 as a time where he showed great selfishness and contempt for his younger sister, who was a devout evangelical, and a lack of respect toward his father. In a letter to his friend Morgan Walter Jones of St. John's, Martin, about to return from his break in Cambridge, wrote, "My time has been so taken up with the nice girls that I never think of Cambridge without silent horror. Indeed, I dread to begin to read again, as the intense fag necessary to restore me is truly terrific in prospect. Home has many more attractions." This excerpt from an original held here at St. John's Library is the only letter we have of Martin's written prior to his evangelical conversion. 4 months later, at the beginning of January 1800, Henry Martin received news of his father's unexpected death. Finding it difficult to concentrate on academics, he began a period of religious reflection. In his words, "I took up my Bible thinking that the consideration of religion was rather suitable for this solemn time. Nevertheless, I often took up other books to engage my attention and should have continued to do so had not Kempthorne advised me to make this time an occasion for serious reflection. I began with the Acts as being the most amusing, and while I was entertained with the narrative, I found myself insensibly led to inquire more attentively into the doctrines of the apostles." Martin's evangelical conversion came in two stages. His father's death, as he described it, stopped me in the career of worldliness and turned me from the paths of sin. 3.5 years later, he states that he entered into a deeper level of consecration and turned to the Lord with all his heart. As he inquired more deeply into his newfound faith, Martin fell naturally into Charles Simeon's orbit. Charles Simeon was a fellow of King's College, Cambridge, and for 54 years, vicar of Trinity Church. From this location, Simeon wielded significant influence in the evangelical movement by developing exceptional candidates for ministry at home and eventually abroad. Targeting students at Cambridge, Simeon provided every help in training and eventually placing them in ministry, even to the point of purchasing 21 earnings in which he likely even could be placed. His close ties to the central figures in the evangelical movement allowed him to act as a placement agency for some of the best evangelical talent available. Candidates for ministry were assessed and cultivated in the context of weekly, so-called conversation parties. These parties, along with the regular meetings for Bible study and prayer, allowed evangelical students to develop a group of friends and future contacts, as well as insights into ministry from Simeon himself. Martin was a regular attendee. Daniel Corey, a student of Clare College and future co-worker with Martin, commented that the many gownsmen he could find at Thursday meetings with Simeon were like so many West messengers waiting for instruction with which they were about to post off in all directions. Corey's assessment of Simeon's impact was penetrating, the Cambridge pastor's ministry placing a distinct theological and homiletic imprint on each candidate. The training of Anglican clergy at this time was almost wholly the prerogative of Oxford and Cambridge, the former offering a primarily classical training and the latter a mathematical foundation. Not that this was the sum of such training, as lectures and divinities also were delivered. Martin, when seeking ordination, attested to having attended 51 lectures in divinity while at Cambridge. Nevertheless, the practical training of young clergy was highly dependent on what connections they themselves made with more experienced clergy. And in this regard, evangelical students were especially fortunate in having a mentor such as Simeon. Each of the dozens of pastors, missionaries, and chaplains over which Simeon had an influence received guidance in theology, the delivery of sermons, and the practice of ministry. Simeon was not obsessed with theology for its own sake, but rather in its direct relationship to the salvation of his hearers. His training thus focused on the content of the preached word, instilling a love for clarity and practicality in his young followers. Simeon developed large numbers of sermonic outlines that he and his friends referred to as skeletons, which could be used to by those he mentored in writing their own sermons. In 1796, he published an essay of sermon construction, to which he attached an appendix of 100 skeletons that he had used in preaching at the university. Serving in the parish of Lulworth during the year prior to his departure, Martin made extensive use of Simeon's skeletons in composing his own sermons. In a letter to his friend John Hinsman, he writes of his sermon preparation during his curacy. For Trinity Church, if I have a week before me, a sermon engrosses a week. For Lulworth, I have generally taken one of the skeletons and begun on Friday evening. Critical though it was to Martin's development as a young minister, his association with Simeon had its price. Simeon was not highly regarded by high church elements of the Church of England, and candidates for ministry associated with him or with his evangelical message might find a bishop unwilling to ordain them, or a clergy unwilling to open their churches for them to preach. When a newly ordained Henry Martin returned from Cambridge to his home city of Truro, he found himself shut out of most churches by his former schoolmaster, Cornelius Cardew. The clergy, he wrote to a friend, seem to have united to exclude me from their churches, so that I must now be contented with my brother-in-law's two little churches 5 miles from Truro. The objection is that Mr. Martin is a Calvinistic preacher in the dissenting way, etc. My old schoolmaster, who has always hitherto been proud of his pupil, has offered his services from any time for a curate near this place, rather than he should apply to me for assistance. Martin was named senior wrangler in 1801, and in the same year was also named first Smith Prize winner in mathematics, matching his friend Kempthorne's achievement 5 years earlier. Martin became a fellow of the college in 1802, and already demonstrating his linguistic capabilities, won first prize in the university for a Latin prose essay. Despite his mathematical and classical attainments, his greatest energies were reserved for his theological studies. His theological reading was steeped in evangelical thought, as he informed his friend John Sargent in a letter. My studies during the last 3 months have been Hebrew, Greek Testament, Jonathan Edwards on original sin, and on the affections, and Bishop Ezekiel Hopkins, your favorite and mine. The work with the greatest impact on the personal level was, as for so many missionary-minded evangelicals of the day, Jonathan Edwards' Life of David Brainerd. First read by Martin in 1802, it was a work that resonated with him for the remainder of his life. 3 years later, he records on a Sabbath day, Mr. Simeon preached on he cannot serve God and mammon in a most clear and powerful manner. Found much edification at night in reading some parts of the sermons of that great man, Jonathan Edwards, as I did of quickening in the morning from David Brainerd. The recurring presence of Edwards' works, not only in Martin's life, but in the lives of other early Anglicans and Baptist missionaries, was one of the unifying strands of the early period of Protestant work in India. Steeped in such fare and much in Simeon's company, it was not surprising that he was drawn to missionary work. In June 1803, he recorded that he had read Sir George Stanton's Embassy to China and was convinced of the propriety of being sent thither. But increasingly, reflecting Simeon's influence, his goal became India. Ordained a deacon under the Bishop of Ely in 23 October 1803, a few days later he was seeking advice as to whether he had the skills necessary to serve as a missionary, apparently in Calcutta. Martin began his curacy to Simeon at All Saints Lulworth, a small rural congregation near Cambridge. The work there proved difficult for the young curate. To be fair, the congregation was probably ill-fitted to a young Cambridge scholar, but he persevered. After several months, Martin reported to his friend Hensman, "The Lulworth people are much as usual. No apparent change among them, I'm sorry to say. I drank tea one evening with Mr. Mann. He has been to church but twice. The congregation begins to increase now that the summer is coming on. It has been very small." Meanwhile, Martin was making regular forays to the hospital and almshouse located on Walls Lane, Cambridge, modern King Street, where he sought to lend comfort and religious instruction. Maturing rapidly into his new responsibilities, in March 1804, he was ordained a priest and was eagerly waiting for assignment. What kind of a man was Martin? Those looking for an answer in his journals find a passionate and deeply devoted man. Yet despite the profound depth and energy exhibited there, readers can't help but note the negative, almost self-flagellating nature of some of his private reflections. For Martin, we must remember the keeping of a journal was not so much an autobiographical effort as a self-study in his spiritual progress. He writes, "I'm convinced that Christian experience in general is not a delusion. Whether mine is or not will be seen at the last day. My object in making this journal is to accustom myself to self-examination, to give my experience a visible form so as to leave an impression on the memory and so to improve my soul in holiness. For the review of such a lasting testimony will serve the double end of conviction and consolation. I desire to collect the habit of my mind to discover my besetting sins, the occasion of calling them forth, and the considerations by which I have at any time been stirred up to duty." Martin's theology and temperament certainly have their darker hues. Nevertheless, the content of the journals is not a sufficient basis upon which to draw conclusions about his temperament. The nature of his journal as a place of confession and reflection before God naturally led it to special observation of those qualities in himself which he found most disturbing. Reflections on Martin by those who knew him in other contexts helps complete the portrait. Mountstuart Elphinstone, the future governor of Bombay, who traveled by boat with Martin from Calcutta to Bombay, deemed Martin, quote, "an excellent scholar and one of the mildest, cheerfulest, and pleasantest men I ever saw." He noted that Martin, while extremely religious, could talk on all subjects as heartily as he could do if he were an infidel. Mary Sherwood, a noted writer of children's books, whose family were close to Martin in India, noted that he had an uncommonly fine voice and fine ear, and loved to sing. for those of us who tend to imagine Martin to be much like the noble but imperious St. John Rivers in Jane Eyre, Mrs. Sherwood provides a welcome corrective. When he relaxed from his labors in the presence of his friends, it was to play and laugh like an innocent, happy child, more especially if children were present, to play and laugh with him. No man I ever met with was more merry among his friends than Henry Martin. He was the most hearty and frequent laugher, a happy spirit, although his private journals are often sad. We can presume Henry was a horseman of some capability,